The on Commerce and Consumer Protection will come to order. It is Thursday, February 12th. I remember that this is Lincoln's birthday. We used to get both Lincoln and Washington's birthday off, and the 12th and the 22nd, but here we are. And I think they're having a big celebration. It's actually the 200th anniversary of his birth. So, anyway, welcome everybody, and we are going to hear, first of all, from the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. I see Ms. Gruber back there. Hello. Why don't you come on up? And then there are several other people that want to speak as well on the subject of MCHA.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Commerce Committee. It is an honor to be testifying on Lincoln's 200th birthday, especially knowing that you have that beautiful picture of Lincoln in the House chambers. But I have prepared for you, with assistance from Medica, who's our administrator, kind of a one-page summary of the important facts that I want to convey to you today. I also have an article that we'll maybe talk about if we have a chance. You might have seen the St. Paul Pioneer Press about how COBRA is becoming unaffordable, and that impacts MCHA. And then finally, we have Medica's our administrator, and they prepared a very nice booklet of colored slides that, again, summarizes better than I ever could some of the key statistics about MCHA, and I hope that you keep it as a resource. It's 2007 data. We won't have 2008 complete for a few more weeks. So with your permission, Madam Chair, I will highlight the back-to-back sheet that you have.
This?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Members should have it in there.
Everybody found that? Not the pie chart, but kind of a stiff piece of paper.
Right. It's a kind of a cart, almost. It's heavier stock.
Exactly.
Yeah. It may be attached to the
booklet.
There it is. I see it.
There you go.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association was created by the legislature over 33 years ago, 1976. And it became operational in 1977. And when it was created, and it was created with the cooperation and full support of the Insurance Federation to serve as Minnesota's, I'm going to call it the high-risk pool, for folks that have ongoing serious chronic conditions. And there, I wasn't there then, but the belief was that the individual market in Minnesota, which is about 250,000 people, would be stronger if the insurers were able to pool the higher-risk folks in one pool. And I'll explain the funding in a few minutes here. But the original purpose of MCHA, as I understand it, back in the 70s, was to be an access for health care coverage. We weren't really dealing with affordability in those days. It was really insurer of last resort. The legislature wanted to make sure everybody could have insurance. Now, MCHA, and I'll call it MCHA or MCHA, is insurance for just individuals. There's no group coverage. This is not a group policy. This is for individuals. And your typical person that needs MCHA will be a self-employed Minnesotan who might be a carpenter, might be an artist that has a chronic disease. It could be asthma. It could be a bad back. Those issues of what is uninsurable and what isn't are really determined by the insurers through their underwriting book.
Ms. Gruber, I think I have two questions. I hope I can remember both of them. When you said there are about 250,000 or like 250,000, how did you put that? Market. Was that then or is that today?
Madam Chair, good question. Today, I'm not sure what it was in 1976,
okay,
but today we have around 250,000 Minnesotans that are in individual plans, and that includes our group of 28,000. That's a rough number.
And then I wanted to ask you, or maybe you're going to get to this, you talked about how you didn't discuss affordability then.
That's right.
Today, do you just have, if you have some kind of a condition, some people may be able to get their own plans. Do they have a choice of going to MCHA? Or maybe?
Madam Chair, you're kind of asking about the price of our premiums and affordability? Yes, let me address that.
Okay.
Today, we have I'm going to say about 8 different plans. And the deductibles range from $500 deductible and then an 80-20 plan to a $10,000 deductible. And the higher your deductible, the lower your premiums. We also have an HSA product. And I believe for individuals, their deductible is around $3,000, something like that. For a family, it's closer to five. So we have a big range of products. They're basically the same. You're talking about just a difference in premium, and the premiums are based on the individual market's premiums. So we look to Minnesota's individual market, and then we find the average of a comparable policy like MCHA, and we are allowed by law to boost that premium as much as 25% above the average. So MCHA's premiums have always been above market, the individual market. It was not created, as some people confuse us with, as Minnesota Care for lower income people. Never created for that reason. And that's one of the points I'm going to try to hit home today. It was really an access issue back in the 70s. Does that answer your question, Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So today we have 20,000 Minnesotans. We've had higher numbers of insureds as the economy has changed, as we've had insurance reform in the legislature, but we're at around 28,000 right now. Every one of you in the room, all our legislators have members of, you have constituents that are in MCHA. We have members in all 87 counties. I believe there's a map in your booklet that'll show you where our people are. But what I want to really say today and emphasize with you, and if you leave the room with nothing else, it is that what we were in 1977 when we were first operational is really not what we are today, because we have become more of a state safety net for other groups of eligibles that are quite costly, and our funding formula has not changed since the 1970s. And you can imagine what happens to MCHA when these different groups, through politics, through legislative policy, and through the issue of unaffordability of COBRA, have now come to our plan. So let me just highlight the critical challenges for MCHA, and then we'll kind of open it up for questions and answers. But so as I said, our mission was to make sure that every Minnesotan that needed health insurance, individual coverage, could find that. And over time, our mission seems to have expanded. We now cover children that may be enrolled in the Minnesota Health Department's program of children with special needs. We definitely cover folks that are HIV positive or have AIDS through the Ryan White program, which is a federal program. We work with the Department of Human Services. They get the money from the federal government. They are able to purchase our premium to make sure that those folks have the important drugs and care that they need. We have about between 400 and 500 members of MCHA are through the Ryan White program. So we are basically supporting them, and you can imagine that the premium we get does not cover the cost of their claims. The legislature also wrote a law back, I'm not sure if it was in the 80s, but I believe retired Senator Skoglin mentioned that there is a statute that allows folks that are paying COBRA, you remember what COBRA is, when you've lost your group coverage, your employer is to offer you a continuation of your insurance. The difficulty with COBRA is that the family or the member is to pay the entire premium. No, there's no subsidy from an employer anymore or anything like that. So, but there's a statute on the books that we respect and we acknowledge that says basically if they cannot continue with their COBRA, or in our state it's continuation coverage. And it doesn't say because it's not affordable, and so that's open to interpretation. Essentially, if the people cannot pay for a COBRA, they may come into MCHA, and we waive our typical 6-month waiting period for the pre-existing condition. So we have about a quarter of our members now coming through that entry door to MCHA. They cannot afford their COBRA. There's a law in the books that says, well, they need to come to MCHA then. and we can waive the six-month waiting period. So that is an important group. It's an expensive group for us. And we'll come back maybe and talk about, was that the true intent of the legislature? Truth of the matter is, you have an article in your packet that explains that COBRA is terribly expensive, and I think you'll find on maybe the second page of that article that if you are unemployed and you have that unemployment check, Families USA did a study that said about 84% of your unemployment check will be spent on your COBRA. So you can see that that's one of our bigger issues, not just for MCHA, but really, you know, for the nation and for our state. So that's we may want to come back to that. So you have a couple of the groups. You have the Ryan White AIDS folks. You have folks that can't afford COBRA that have come to us. We also have a group of children that are autistic whose parents feel that they should have a certain type of treatment, and that treatment is called either LOVAS or Applied Behavioral Analysis, ABA. And what that kind of treatment is it's very intense. It's provided to the child at a very early age, 2, 3, 4. And essentially, the child may need this coverage or this type of treatment for years until they're maybe they're 6 or 7. It's very expensive because it's one-on-one, 8 days, or 8 days, 5 days a week. And so we have a group of, I'm going to say about 50 of those children that are getting that type of coverage, and not all insurers cover it. I don't think controversial is the right word to use. But as you all know, if you've read about autism, there's no one right treatment. I think I'm safe in saying that. And so there are many different types of treatments. Some have been embraced by medicine. Some have been embraced by the behavioral sciences. But I think it's Blue Cross Blue Shield in our state and MCHA do cover ABA or LOVAS treatment. That's another expensive group of folks that we were not covering in the 70s. This has really become a group that we have been covering in the last, I'm going to say, 5 to 6 years. So what we were, which was kind of a plain old insurance of last resort for your self-employed folks or early retirees, has really translated now into or evolved into an insurer that without any ongoing state support is covering many groups that are public policy and legislators have really said, you know, MCHA is the place for them. You need to be the safety net. So my other message today is that the funding source from the 1970s, and that here's what it is. By law, we are allowed to have premiums that are above market. Not endless, but they can be in a range between 101 and 125% of the average individual policy premium sold in Minnesota. Our board has tried to be in about the middle of that range, but in the last couple of years, we're at about 120 to 122%. We're on the high end of the range because our claims losses are so high and because our population is getting older. Our average age is about 47, 48, and we have these new groups of very vulnerable, important Minnesotans that need coverage, but were not contemplated, I'm not sure, in the earlier years. So we have a funding system that's back to the 70s, and we have newer needs and newer challenges. The other portion of our funding, premium gets us about 50% of what we need to run the program. The other portion that premiums doesn't cover is paid for through assessments on all insurers in Minnesota that are selling an insured product. Self-insureds don't pay. 3M, State of Minnesota, whoever is insured because of ERISA does not pay our assessment. And that's a change from the 70s.
And Ms. Gruber, forgive me for interrupting you, but I think that that percent of the market is greatly declined, if I'm not mistaken, to
the insured,
the fully insured piece.
Yes, Madam Chair. And I think maybe Phil Griffin will cover that in terms of how we have shifted. I'm going to say, and my colleagues will correct me if I'm wrong, that about 60% of the market is self-insured these days, leaving, there's public insurance and so forth, but about 60%. And, of course, that's not what it was like in the 70s. So when MCHA started, there was no ERISA law. And the legislature wisely thought about a broad funding mechanism, and that included self-insured companies at the time. So back in the 70s, the model was everybody that was providing health care benefits would participate in the losses of MCHA. We were designed to have losses. This is not a surprise. But the assessment process is how the legislature addressed paying the expenses that exceeded premiums. The assessments today, then, are paid for by the insurance companies, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Medica, Health Partners, Preferred One. Any company that actually sells an insured product in Minnesota for health care will pay a portion of our losses. And the formula for that is that whatever portion of the market they have, you know, if Blue Cross is 30% of the market, they will pay 30% of our losses. So it's in direct proportion to their market share or their total premium. Well, I'm going to give you a figure that's going to be a bit staggering for us that have followed MSHA through the years, but we are anticipating that our losses for 2009 may reach as much as $150 million. And it's not because we aren't doing disease management. It's not because we don't have a provider network that we feel is the right provider network or an administrator. Right now it's Medica. It was Blue Cross before that. That is helping us with cost-effective ways to manage care. It's because the cost of care is extremely high, and our members may have one or two chronic diseases.
Ms. Gruber, excuse me. Senator Johnson, did you?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to understand, you're getting the premiums, you're getting the underwriters' percentage, and you're getting state funding, you're getting three.
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, let me clarify. I'm sorry, I did not make that clear for you. The only funding sources we have right now are premiums, premium revenue that's above market. That will produce about 50% of what we need. The other source of our funding right now is an assessment on all insurance companies that write health care insurance in the state of Minnesota.
So just two.
There's just two sources. Thank you, Senator.
And I think that the state has put some money toward MSHA several times at least.
Yes,
I think,
Madam
since
Chair.
I've been here.
I think my remarks say that there's three times that we've had state funding.
Three.
Once in 1977 to start us up. Once in 1997, when there was a surplus in the Health Care Access Fund, we received $30 million to be applied toward our losses in 98 and 99, so for $15 million, so $30 million in 1997. And then in 2001, there, I believe, was a surplus in the workers' comp assigned risk pool. We got $15 million at that time, which we applied to pay down our losses.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not to be unsensitive, but it sounds like what you're doing for the autistic patients might be a little outside the box. Mm-hmm. Have you considered maybe not allowing it?
I was actually,
sure.
Thank you for asking the question, Senator Johnson. I was going to ask you how people get into that if other, I know that there are plans that don't cover all kinds of treatment.
Right. Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, very good question. And autism is a condition that we're still finding a lot about. And, you know, we're regulated by the Commerce Department. And normally we at MCHA follow the health treatment guidelines, let's put it that way, of our administrator. And our administrator right now is Medica. We contract out for the day-to-day operations of the health plan. And Medica does not cover ABA or LOVAS therapy, as do many other insurers, because we do not find clear evidence either way on what are the most effective treatments for autism. So I think that the Commerce Department was swayed by the fact that since there's no even level body of clinical medicine that says one way is better than the other, one way is more effective than the other, their feeling was parents feel that it does work. There is some evidence that after a few years the children are streamlined into school, the normal school, which is the goal, to make sure that they can be mainstream, I guess is the best word I want to use, into normal society and school. And so, Senator Johnson, It's not our intention to try to take that treatment away. We certainly respect our regulators, and I think that you'll even find at the University of Minnesota there are some pediatricians and clinicians that feel it's very important. I attended a meeting at Mayo Clinic, and there one of their chairs of the pediatric department felt that ABA has some great promise. So I think what I'm trying to say is we don't know what the best treatment is for autism. And at MCHA, you know, we are following the guidelines of our regulators at Commerce who said you will provide it your insurance a last resort. So what we have tried to do is to negotiate well with the few providers that do provide that treatment, and we feel very comfortable that in the last year we've made great grounds in trying to share the cost and have more reasonable fees that we are paying. So we're trying to deal with the cost of that group through really negotiations.
Yeah, because it can be very expensive, mm-hmm. right? $100,000 a year, maybe. I mean, do families then just enroll the child?
Thank you, Senator. You asked me how does a child get there? Sometimes a child will come from a family that has self-insurance. They may work for a big company that has self-insurance, and that plan of coverage may not cover ABA treatment. Okay. And so there's no rule that says that if they want to buy an MCHA policy, you know, they can because they don't have coverage for that treatment. So they'll look in the private market for that coverage. The child has autism, they'll be rejected because they have a condition, and we are the only insurance company, if you will, that actually is covering it besides Blue Cross Blue Shield. Does that help?
Thank you. Thank you. Very interesting. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I had a meeting, so I got here a few minutes late. I'm not sure if you've touched on this or not, but we've heard at the federal level that President Obama is talking about eliminating the ability of insurance companies to rate policies based on pre-existing conditions. If that actually becomes law, is that going to do a lot? I would think that would do a lot to reduce the number of people who would end up turning to MSHA for coverage.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Gruber.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, if that comes to pass, which is essentially guaranteed issue, it sounds like to me. Mm-hmm. There'd be no need for MCHA. So I think the issue would be what happens to the people that are currently there? What happens to the 28,000 that are currently there? Do they go apply for new insurance? Probably so. We don't know the details. We don't know if it's going to happen. But, Senator Olson, I think one of the points I want to make is that if there doesn't need to be an MCHA, fine. If in our world of policy changes, both at the state level and the federal level, if the policy changes to the point where nobody is denied coverage, then there is no need for any of the risk pools in the country. I mean, we're the biggest, we're the oldest, but there are 34 other risk pools in the United States because we know that for now we need to be there. We know health reform is on the way, and that's part of my message as well. We believe we need to be where we are to take care of all these vulnerable people. And to do that, we are asking the legislature to think about a broader funding mechanism. And that's really addressed on the back side of the sheet that I've handed out to you. We don't know what the best source would be, but we do believe that we need to broaden the groups that are helping to support MCHA. And that could be through an increased provider tax. We know that the provider tax has gone through a court test that says that, you know, self-insureds do have to pay it. That would broaden our funding. It could be a dedicated tax, something like a portion of cigarette or tobacco revenue. But what we're saying to you today is that what we were back in the 70s has largely changed to a broader network, a broader safety net, I will say, broader safety net for the state of groups that weren't anticipated back in the 70s or 80s. And you know, if there were just one group that you have to think about that we didn't have then that we have now, it's the COBRA. It's the folks that can't afford COBRA.
Ms. Gruber, is there anything in the federal stimulus package that has to do with mm-hmm. COBRA? And do you have any idea how that might work?
Madam Chair, yes, there is. I haven't seen the final bill. I don't even know if it's been totally negotiated. I think it has. But at one juncture, there was going to be some money to the states to help unemployed people pay their COBRA, which would take the pressure off of MCHA. I don't know if that survived in the final. Okay. I'm getting a nod on the head that might have survived. So if that is true, that will take the pressure off of us if folks are trying to pay their COBRA through an unemployment check.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but that doesn't affect the people that have exhausted their COBRA. They would still need you.
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, that's right. If they've already exhausted COBRA and they still have a condition, then they'd have to come to MCHA.
And so that, can you just tell me, and then Senator Olson, I'll call you, but you said something about, where did I write it? About the loss this year, $109 million. How does that compare to projected loss, I should say?
Yeah.
How does that compare to where we've been in the last few years?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and committee members, I wish it was $109 million.
Well, what did you say? I'm sorry.
I actually said for 2009, I need to enunciate, it's me, it's not you. For 2009, we are looking at losses of $150 million.
Oh, I've got it written. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I heard the nine.
That's all right.
$150 million.
We think for 2008, as we're finalizing our numbers, we're going to be closer to $140 million. And since 1999, the losses have really tripled.
Okay.
So if you can keep that in your minds, and it's on the sheet, you know, we've tripled the losses.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Gruber. And, and I think, you know, what your testimony points out is how interrelated all of these health care issues are.
Yes.
That the costs never really go away. If we try to reduce the cost in one place, it just ends up shifting somewhere else under the model we have. And on the, you know, on the bright side, maybe there'll be some changes at the federal level that will maybe help with the situation, whether the need goes away entirely or just some pressure is taken off. But on the flip side of that, I think if we look at the governor's proposal this year, what we're hearing in Health and Human Services is that the cuts to reimbursement rates for government-paid health care programs are going to require health care providers to simply raise their charges to the self-pay or the insured individuals under mm-hmm. private insurance. The more those rates go up, the more businesses tend to not be able to offer that product, the more people have to become, you know, either uninsured or looking at options like MSHA. And so, you know, those costs by reducing the reimbursement rates might save some money mm-hmm. in one aspect of the budget, but then end up circling their way back around mm-hmm. and just coming home to roost in another part of our budget.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, you got it perfectly. You know, it's the balloon. You push it one side, and it's okay on one side, but it's pushing on the other. Yes, MCHA is definitely interrelated and is, I think my colleagues will back me up on this, is an integral part of our healthcare system today. We're lucky to have it. We're lucky that the legislature was so wise to create it back in the 70s. Our model has served as the model for most of the other 34 risk pools in the country. We're highly respected. Our administration costs are low. They're around 5.7%, sometimes lower. We've had good administrators, Blue Cross and Medica, that have helped us do that. We have a lean staff. So, you know, we have our responsibilities, and the board does, to find cost savings where we can and when we can. And we're always on that march, believe me. But as I noted before, and as you'll probably read in some of the graphs that we have, you know, we have folks with the primary reason they come to us are cancer, heart, diabetes, and actually being overweight. And as we know, when you're terribly overweight, you're going to have hypertension, and you're going to possibly lead into diabetes and so forth. So the number one reason to come to MCHA in the last year or so has been height and weight. You know, it's been obesity, basically. And then following that is cancers in heart and so forth. So, you know, the chronic diseases often are more than one. They often have more than one chronic disease. We have been working with some disease management companies to help us help the members. and we're very happy with that direction. We were happy to understand that Medica introduced an internet program that's kind of a self-help and self-education tool that we have provided incentives for our members to use it. And we have, I'm proud to say, we have about 400 of our members that won the right to a $100 check at the end of the year and four gift certificates to vendors all over the state because they participated and earned their credits. And we think that this program is, it's essential because we know that all members, all of us in this room, have to do certain things, have to take certain responsibility for our our health and our conditions. And one of the board's strong feelings is if you give the members the tools they need, they can help themselves to at least a state where they may be maintaining and not getting any worse than they were. So we believe we are doing the right things to help members manage their care and to find the cost savings where we can. But at the end of the day, our mission has changed. It's broadened to help certain folks, and I've mentioned these few groups, the autistic children that want a particular type of treatment, the ABA treatment, folks that can't afford their COBRA, the Ryan White folks that are HIV positive or AIDS that are getting assistance through the federal government to pay for their diseases. As we know with the economic scene, unemployed folks may not be able to go on with their COBRA, and they may come to us. So we're hoping that we can help these folks, but the message I want to leave you with today is that we don't think we can go on much longer with the funding formula or our funding mechanism of the 1970s, because the group I didn't mention, the true payers of the assessment, once it's actually paid by the insurers have to run a business, so they're going to shift or share that cost with insured folks and customers that buy their products in the form of a higher premium. And that number now, if you take a couple things home, is going to be about 2.5% more in their premium bill than it was without MCHA. Because, as I said, the self-insureds don't pay the assessment. And as more companies go either self-insured or offer no insurance at all, our pool of companies that pay the assessment gets smaller, putting more pressure on the fewer companies to raise the premiums for their insured customers even higher. So it's small business, it's individuals buying an individual product that actually are paying this 2.5% more in their premium. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Senator Olson, did you want to
say? Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just make one final comment on that. You know, if a person works for a large company, they're not going to have their insurance cost rated based on their health. But if they're working for a small business and is going to have their insurance rated based on their claims history, or if they're an individual and simply just gets turned down altogether because it's not profitable for the insurance company to insure that person, these are the people who end up in MSHA, usually because they have a health condition. They're probably in the position least able to pay, you know, that they can least afford to pay for these higher rates. So you have the people who are least, you know, able to pay being charged the most for health insurance. And I know that's not your fault. I mean, that's how MSHA was designed or set up. But it really is a system that is unworkable at many levels for that reason, as well as some of the reasons you've described.
Madam Chair, can I say one other thing? You mentioned, the committee members have mentioned the federal government and the economic stimulus package. But we do have to give thanks to Congress because of the organization that the national risk pools have. It's called NASCHIP. We grouped together a number of years ago to compare notes and to not recreate the wheel with operations. We share information all the time between pools to see if somebody has a better idea for cost savings and better management. But one of the advantages of us grouping together was to be able to lobby Congress back in 2002 for some few funds to help some of our lower income members pay our premiums. So we were able to, all the risk pools that have premiums at a certain level, were able to get some federal money. And just this past year, we were able to help about 2,700 of our members with a subsidy check to help pay for their premiums. That's not ongoing. You know, we have to beg for that every year. But it's one way that we've been able to at least help the lowest income of our members pay that insurance premium, which they desperately need. So we have had some help from the federal government. Whether or not that continues is very questionable. But, you know, the real answer is hopefully changing the funding mechanism to find that broader way to fund MCHA. And on the bottom of the second back sheet, we've indicated just a couple of ways, and would really appreciate it if you all would think about that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Gruber, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And there are some other folks who would like to comment on MCHI. I have Phil Griffin, Mike Hickey, and Stacia Smith. If you want to come up, you certainly may. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome, Mr. Griffin.
It's a pleasure to be back, and as Ms. Gruber said, an honor to be here in front of the Commerce Committee. On Lincoln's 200th birthday anniversary, I thought it might be appropriate to quote the great president who said that all I am or can be, I owe to my angel mother. And I would just reiterate that before some of my other friends pull out another Lincoln quote, which is the one about 'tis better to be thought a fool and be silent than to open your mouth and have it proven. That being said, Madam Chair, I am Phil Griffin. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I represent both Preferred One and UCARE, who are members of the council. The council represents the 8 nonprofit health plans here in the state of Minnesota. And you have before you two sheets that we would like to show you and give you a little bit of our view of MCHA. And I think Ms. Gruber has given you a very good overview of the program. We strongly support at this point in time the work that MCHA is doing, and the board and staff have done a great job of providing what Ms. Gruber described, and is really true. It's the trophy of the high risk pools in the state, in the country, and we really are proud of the work that they do and happy to be a part of that work. But we do want to bring some concerns before the committee as you look at all the issues that you have coming before you this session. MCHA is one that particularly stands out as it divides the world in between those who pay the assessment and those who don't. And so to start with that, the first chart is the pie chart that is entitled at the top, Where Minnesotans Get Their Health Insurance, rather, from 1993. And you notice in that we have down in the far right-hand corner in white the indemnity, Blue Cross, Blue Shield programs, and the fully insured HMOs down there in the 19 and 20% range, and the government programs pretty much where they are today. But you'll see that the self-funded plans have grown fairly dramatically. And this, remember, is being compared with the chart down below, which is 2005 data. That's the latest data, that we have available from the health department. These are not our numbers. These are numbers from the State Department of Health. You can see that growth from the 29% to the 40%. And I can assure you, as someone who is providing third-party administrator services through my clients to large insurers, that we have seen an acceleration in the growth since 2005 in the number of groups that are becoming self-insured. And that's why I'll take you to the second chart and give you just a very brief indication of why that's happening. And the second chart is a chart, bar graph of the increase in Minnesota healthcare taxes that are being paid by plans. And you see at the bottom of the chart across all three bars, the white is the provider tax that we all pay that funds the Minnesota Care Program here in Minnesota, something that we support and believe should continue on, but it is a cost that is added to all of your health insurance, whether you're self-insured, whether you're personal private pay, or whether you're fully insured. Then you move up to the next chart, which is next bar, rather, which is the medical assistance surcharge, which goes on hospitals as well. That's a 1.5% charge. And then the next one goes up, and that's the one that falls upon small employers here in Minnesota, and that's the MCHA surcharge. It is now reaching a point where it is over 2% of premium just for MCHA. And the chair will remember and recall when it was just a very minor tenths of percent in the full charge that we paid out of MCHA, but it has continued to grow and continues to grow dramatically. These are 2008 numbers on this chart. And then you also have two other things that fall upon the plans, whether they are HMOs or whether they are insurers. One of them is the Minnesota Care Premium Tax, which falls on the HMOs at a 1% level, or if you're an insured company, you have a 2% premium tax. And then last but not least is the MA surcharge, which the plans pay and the insureds do not. And so you end up with almost 7% of premium going into taxes and assessments. Madam Chair, that makes it very easy when we sit down with an employer and they're trying to look at a way to save health insurance dollars for them to make a decision on whether or not they ought to be fully insured or remain in that market or move to the self-insured market. If you can save 7% or just over 6% of premium, that's a fairly easy decision for employers to make. And as a result, we've seen an increase in the number of people that are choosing that, and we've also seen a decrease in the size groups who have chosen that, as they've decided, even if they aren't a large group, and I remember at a time when you didn't fully insure your group, or self-insure your group, rather, unless you were thousands of employees.
Mr. Griffin, I was going to ask you, how low can that count be for employees? I mean,
Madam Chair, there is no federal limitation, okay, and members of the committee, on how low you can go. Most plans will tell you that there is a number below which you shouldn't go from a risk standpoint. The question becomes whether or not you can find somebody who will cover stop-loss insurance at a very low rate. And as long as you can find stop-loss insurers to do it, there are insurers out there that are willing to go down into group sizes below 20, below 15. And that's a very dangerous territory, we think. And I think you'll find amongst our plan members, we don't go that low, if that answers the question.
Okay, so there are, but there are some folks out there in that size. Wow.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, that's the formal presentation, the part that we have. I do want to just point out one thing. I was looking up while I was listening to Ms. Gruber and recalling a debate we had here in the I guess it was down in room 15, although we did discuss it briefly here in the Commerce Committee, which was when the state decided to move to self-insurance, and the state decided that it didn't want to pay the MCHA assessment. And so in 1991, you exempted yourselves and all the state employees and the benefits that are paid on their behalf from that assessment. And so you no longer pay that, which also increased the size of the pool. But as you make decisions, we would urge you to be fully cognizant of what goes on in the self-insured market. We are not pointing bad fingers at bad employers and saying they aren't covering benefits and they aren't doing things. They're acting in the best interest of their employees and trying to provide health care, and we're working with them. But there is something that happens when you move to self-insurance, and part of it is an inability of us to try and help fund those programs that go on. And we want to continue with those programs. We think they're very important. And if there are questions from members of the committee, we'd be happy to answer them. I'd love to go back and talk about the history of health insurance in the state, and we could talk about not only MCHA, which was founded at the same time this was, but our major changes in health insurance at that time and the CHEP program, Catastrophic Health Expense Protection Program,
right. Oh, yes.
Which fell by the wayside. And I think, Madam Chair, you're the only one that was here when that still existed.
Thank you for pointing that out. Well, I'm not 200 anyway. Mr. Griffin, you said that the state plan that we don't pay MCHA. I thought we did, but maybe.
Madam Chair, we did up until 1991. And in 1991, in Section 72 of Article 1 of the Omnibus Appropriations Bill, we put in a provision in 43A.22. Parens B, that says the commissioner may self-insure any hospital and medical plan offered under sections 43A.22 to 43A.31 to promote reasonable, stable, and predictable premiums for hospital and medical benefits paid by the state and its employees to their dependents and medical providers. And that passed and has been implemented. So the state does work through carriers that are licensed with the state. That was part of the original legislation as well. So that right now you have to go through one of these carriers, but it's our TPA arm, not our fully insured arm.
Very interesting. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had the pleasure of getting to know our speaker when I was working on the Healthcare Access Commission, one of the working groups. And And I think just to highlight a couple of the net results of what's being discussed here, and especially with regard to pushing people more towards self-insurance, the difference in cost between those small businesses that are still left having to pay more of this is really causing a lot of disparity in cost for health insurance between Sure. people working for small businesses who tend to be more in the rural areas versus people who are working for larger businesses who not all are in the metro, but a lot of them are. And you have the irony that people who are generally earning substantially less in wages are actually paying substantially more for their health care, which is kind of a double whammy if you're in a rural community. And then the other thing that I would say, and especially true, I was really surprised to learn that you can buy stop-loss insurance down to as low as, what was it, like $20,000? I think $20,000 is the most risk you have to have to still call yourself self-insured. But then the final point I wanted to make was there's another reason for this committee to be concerned about people moving more towards self-insurance, and that's the fact that if you're self-insured, you are not subject to any of the state's consumer protection laws. And so we saw this when people fell down, you know, when the bridge fell down, the subrogation rules that said that they had to pay back for their health insurance, medical costs, before they could have any compensation for their own losses. They were, because of all the attention put on that particular case, the self-insured companies waived it, but they usually don't. So any of those consumer protections that we have in place for people dealing with health insurance don't apply when you're talking about self-insured companies.
Thank you. Mr. Griffin, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If there are other questions, be happy to answer.
Okay, Mr. Hickey, we're going to move along because I don't know how long we have, and then Ms. Smith, I thought, I do see her. So right after you.
Madam Chair, welcome. Members. Well, thanks. I'm Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business Minnesota. We represent 13,000 members statewide and have a significant member base in your district and have about 55% to 60% of our members in what would be considered rural Minnesota. This has really turned into one of the great inequities around here, and we also see it in the mandated benefits. But the fact that this assessment is falling harder and disproportionately more on small employers and individuals while the largest companies in the state don't pay it is really concerning. And that's the way we're structured here, but it's getting worse and worse, as you know. And we're very concerned to hear that this assessment's up to 2.6%. As Mr. Griffin mentioned years ago, it was a percentage of a decimal point, and now we're at 2.6%. So you look at that over 10 years alone. This is a great chart here from the Council of Health Plans, but if you just look at that alone, that'd be 20% more a small employer or an individual, worse yet, an individual would pay than a large company for just MCHA, and it's not even 20%. It's more than that now. At 2.6%. The history on this is that we used to do this right. The state used to pay for the deficit in MCHA, and I don't know if it was 1988 or 89, it was in the late 80s. They made a bad change in a conference committee. Can you believe that? And I think somebody was trying to get at some insurer to send some message, but they used to assess the plans, and then they would credit them back. And so this deficit was appropriately paid for by the general fund, and they had a mechanism to handle it in the interim. And that went by the wayside with a real bad change that's never been rectified. And it's one of the big regrets a lot of us have on this issue is during the late 90s and the early 2000s, we had some tremendous surpluses and some tremendous exuberance in this building. Unlike now, we could never get this done. And it was one of our biggest regrets when the state was sitting on huge multi-billion-dollar surpluses. We could not find that, whatever Ms. Gruber said, roughly that $100 million, that $150 million now to pay for this and correct a great inequity. And so you look at this 27%, the other great chart here, and it's just really startling. And I'm sure it is to you, Madam Chair, because you've been involved in this issue for a long time. 27%. Of the private insured market, if you look at the pie chart in the lower example, is in the private, is affected by what the state does around here. Only 27% of the private insurance market is affected by the MCHA assessment, the mandates, and everything else, meaning 73% of the people are virtually not being touched by anything the state does. And so that is exasperating this MCHA deficit. And unless something big happens at the federal level or some other change occurs, I'm sure Ms. Gruber will be in here telling you that this assessment is way over 3% someday, because that number is only going to dwindle. And so that is just one of the great inequities here. And we see it in the mandates, too, the fact that people are still trying to mandate on only 27% of the insured population. Maybe the legislators don't even realize it now, that it's dwindled that low, meaning they're not touching 73% of the private market and what they're doing, and they're still trying to do it. And it's just absolutely incomprehensible to me and my group that this is continuing. If you go to this chart, though, which is all from the health plans, it's really amazing, this disparity of either 6.28% vis-a-vis 2.26% or 6.68% vis-a-vis 2.66% for assessments and other health insurance taxes. And so that is just a bad situation. It's tilting in the wrong direction. Unless something dramatic happens, that's really interesting update, Senator Olson, if something did happen at the federal level to make the need for MCHA to go away, would take care of part of the problem. But unless, minus something like that, or the state really getting dedicated to addressing this problem, which is kind of hard to comprehend in the current fiscal environment we're in, this is just going to get worse and worse, and this inequity is going to get worse likely every year. And finally, it's just really disappointing to my group that the state does not pay for their, my understanding is they don't pay for the MCHA assessment.
That's what I guess we don't.
Right, and the promise was they were going to, even though they went self-insured, even though the state bailed out of the state-regulated market and went self-insured, they quit paying it due to our fiscal problems, and that is just also, you know, increasingly disappointing to a small business or an individual. They're paying, the state's not paying even. And so this is a very concerning situation, and I think we really missed an opportunity in the early 2000s and the late 1990s to correct it, and I don't know when we ever will, and minus some dramatic thing happening. But thanks for the time.
Mr. Hickey, thank you. Senator Olson?
Well, just thank you, Madam Chair. My final comment would be actually in our last hearing, this committee passed a bill that would fix all of this, called the Minnesota
just
Health
Plan. 2 days
plan.
Ago.
and the difference between just taking the MCHA assessment tax and putting it on the backs of taxpayers, because whether it goes on a small number of premiums or a larger number of taxpayers, it's going to be paid through taxes, where, you know, taxpayers are then going to have to pay to insure the sickest people in the state. Well, the insurance industry maintains the profitable people to insure. The idea of the Minnesota Health Plan is it pools all of those people together, and that's another reason why the overall premiums would be less that way than, you know, this kind of bifurcated system that we're discussing here.
Ms. Smith, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Stacia Smith, and I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just want to quickly comment. I know you've heard a lot of points already today on MSHA. But first, to start out, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is the largest business advocacy organization in the state. We represent over 2,700 members around the state, 80% of which are small employers. 80% have 100 or fewer employees. And so, as you have already heard, the MSHA assessment directly impacts the premium prices for those in the fully insured market, which are made up of small to mid-sized employers and individuals. And given that, the Chamber has a policy on MSHA, and I just want to go through the 4 points of what we would recommend as changes to ensure that rates are more predictable and stable for those who are in the fully insured market. First, we feel that it's important to itemize the amount of the premiums and dollars attributed to the MSHA assessment and the premium tax on the health insurance monthly statement and yearly medical statement for those insured in the fully insured market, so that it's more transparent in terms of what the actual cost is. And as the costs rise, employers are able to see that. Second, that terminated employees should not qualify for MSHA simply because they cannot afford continuation or coverage under COBRA. Third, ensure that MSHA rates do not compete and in no case are lower than rates in the private market. And then lastly, we feel that there should be a broader-based funding source for MSHA.
What do you think terminated employees should do?
That's a good question, Madam Chair. My understanding is that if that terminated employees who can qualify under COBRA but feel they can't afford it, that maybe they can afford it. I'm not. I don't have a great answer for you other than that would be part of the uninsured market, or maybe someone else has some ideas. But That is our policy.
I guess we feel we are concerned about those people in any case. I mean, I understand where you're coming from, I guess, but you might take back to the membership when they're discussing this that if they have a better idea of how to do this, they probably don't want to support Senator Marty's plan. I know you were here a couple days ago, but Senator Olson, did you?
Well, and Madam Chair, I was going to say, I mean, these are not people whose care is going to go away, as we've all, you know, been talking about here in the last couple of meetings. And if they don't have access, I mean, being unemployed, they probably aren't going to be able to afford MSHA either. But assuming that they could, it's still more cost-effective for them to be under some type of plan than end up with no insurance and then likely accessing care through an emergency room.
If I could just respond to that,
yes,
too.
Ms. Smith.
I do appreciate that, and I just want to reinforce that from the small to mid employers' perspective, the impact that this is having, the premium increases that they're experiencing, they're not offering health insurance to their employees. So even those who are employed are no longer going to be eligible for or not going to have insurance to their employers. So where I understand where you're coming from, absolutely, we've got people who are. Just to illustrate this, I used to be the manager of our small business committee. And these are folks who are very civic-minded, who come and participate in our committee and in our policies and review each policy that we bring to the Capitol each year. And of these folks, all of them offered health care insurance when I first started with the chamber 4 years ago. And as of this year, less than half offer health care insurance to their employees. And of those half that still offer health care insurance, almost all of them are offering HSAs. So if that at all indicates what's happening in the private and fully insured market, I want to be clear that our goal is not to leave people uninsured, but that we still ensure that those who are in the fully insured market are able to offer health care insurance.
Your comments are showing, I mean, this is burying us. You know, we really are. Mm-hmm. Senator Olson.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate those comments, and I would only say Ms. Smith, that and I share those same concerns, because most of the businesses in my district are small and mid-sized businesses, and I'm very aware of exactly what you're saying. That's why I guess I would just really appreciate it if we could continue to have discussions about the Minnesota Health Plan, because sometimes I think some philosophical differences versus, you know, this is free market and or even misunderstandings of that plan are preventing access to something that would really drive down costs and make the playing field much more level for those small and mid-sized businesses. And when I talk to them one-on-one, very many of them are in support of that plan as opposed to sort of an overall chamber position on it. And so I just hope we can at least have that dialogue.
Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now, members, we're going to... was there anybody else who wanted to say anything about MSHA? No. Then Professor Kleiner is going to talk to us about occupational licensing. You know, we are going to have at least one bill, if not more, concerning occupational licensing. And we became aware. Is it Dr. Kleiner?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Of Dr. Kleiner's work. And... he's going to share with us his wisdom after studying this. Dr. Kleiner, welcome to our Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here. I am on the faculty at the University of Minnesota. However, the presentation that I'm going to present are only my views and not necessarily those of the University of Minnesota, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, where I also have an appointment, or the National Bureau of Economic Research. This book that is in front of you, hopefully you also have copies of these PowerPoint presentations. If not, I'll be delighted to provide those to you.
We do have that, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to share some of the basic findings, really present an overview of the findings of this book and a forthcoming book on the same topic. This first book received quite a bit of attention. It was reviewed in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal and in Scientific American, and was asked to present some of the findings to a number of congressional and Senate staff committees. The overview of what the book provides is an introduction to the topic, the development of occupational licensing as a labor market institution with a focus on the state of Minnesota, some of the quality and demand for occupational licensing. You'll notice, at least from some of the terminology, that I'm an economist, and you'll find much of the terms very much related to economic terms and jargon, although I will certainly try to reduce that. Licensing, labor supply and earnings, some state regulatory policies and economy-wide impacts, and also some impacts for Minnesota. Then comparing how licensing works in different institutional environments, comparing the U.S. and the European Union, and the development of labor market institutions, some policy recommendations on occupational licensing. So as background, want to show what issues of competition and regulation. And this is the statute that is outside the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C., where I've had an opportunity to do some work. And I always noticed this statute really reflected what I thought were the tension that policymakers face dealing with the tensions of reining in the forces of the market, which is represented by the horse, without breaking its spirit. So I think in many ways that is reflects some of the tension that you face in dealing with issues of occupational regulation. Well, what are the forms of occupational regulation? There are three main forms, starting with licensing, which is the most restrictive form. Anyone who is paid for work and is licensed, it is illegal. On the second form, certification, and that is a right to title. So you can't use a particular title. If you open up a hamburger stand, you can't use McDonald's in terms of a title for that particular right to use that particular handle in providing a service. And third, the least restrictive form is registration, where an individual is listed on a board or listed on a state listing, where individuals who might complain against that person would be viewed, and that individual could be taken off that list. For example, the Better Business Bureau forms, in many ways, a listing of registration. So those are, in general, the forms that occupational regulation take. And this is across states as well as federal and state and local forms of either licensing, certification, and registration. Well, I thought I'd give you some examples of individuals who may who are or are not licensed. And these are individuals who were licensed government workers. On the left is former President Bush, who is not licensed other than being an airline pilot, but not related to his occupation. Senator McCain, who is also not licensed, and head of the Federal Reserve Board, Ben Bernanke, who has a PhD but is not licensed. On the bottom left is former President Clinton, who was licensed as an attorney. President Obama, who is a licensed attorney in the state of Illinois, and Representative and Speaker Pelosi, who is not licensed. So there's a wide variation in individuals, and I'll let you decide who provides greater quality, licensed or not. Should CEOs be licensed? Bill Gates, who at one time was the richest person in America, Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha, at one time was licensed, but certainly has not been licensed for a long period of time. At the bottom is Jeff Skilling Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling. You may remember them from the Enron scandal and all the problems that were created in that organization. Ken Lay had a PhD. Jeff Skilling was the top of his graduating class at the Harvard Business School, yet became involved in unscrupulous behavior, regardless of their academic or licensing credentials. What is the potential loss of innovation as a result of additional regulation? Professor Leo Hurwitz, who is the only Nobel Prize winner, was the only Nobel Prize winner at the University of Minnesota, did not either have a PhD or a license, but was able to show his abilities to solve some very important economic problems dealing with the role of institutions in the economy. Yet, if there were licensing at the university, he wouldn't, unfortunately, he would not have had a position there. Now, one of the issues is, does licensing eliminate charlatans, incompetence, or frauds, and will it protect the public? Well, one of the issues in this case is that licensing may or may not do that. In this case, a cartoon from The New Yorker, he built his own airplane from a kit. Apparently, airplane parts are falling from the sky. No Captain Schulenberger from U.S. Air was on this flight to save them, so unfortunately, scrap is falling from the sky. And the question is, does government regulation eliminate these incompetent individuals and make sure things or airplanes, in this case, are appropriately regulated and provide a high-quality service? Well, what, in fact, are, what has been going on with licensing? And one of the focus, one of the key points of this book that I wrote was to deal with what's going on in terms of labor market institutions. And in this case, you'll notice the green line shows the decline of one major labor market institution, unions, and you'll notice they were about 33% of the U.S. economy in the 1950s and have declined to around 12% currently. On the other hand, the institution that you are regulating, that is occupational licensing, has grown from about 4.5% to now representing 29% of the U.S. workforce. Also, at the bottom, it shows that more than 800 occupations are now licensed by state governments. That doesn't mean that these occupations are licensed in every state, but there are 800 occupations that are licensed in at least one state. So this is a very important growing area, in part due to the service economy, due to transformations that have occurred, and also the fact that occupations have sought and have received a licensing by the various states. This is part of a new book that I'm putting together, and this is a part of some of the data we were able to collect at Princeton University with my co-author on this particular article, Alan Krueger, who teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School there. We were able to get funds for Princeton University to contract with the Gallup organization, which you in politics very much familiar with, also another organization, Westat. And this was funded, and this was a survey very much like the surveys that Gallup and Westat conduct in terms of measuring the pulse of political issues. But we asked a very different set of questions. And the questions and answers that we were able to obtain from the survey showed that from our analysis asking a random sample of U.S. workers were that 35% of the respondents answered that they were either licensed or certified. Remember, there's two different categories. Licensing, you need to get paid for work if you're paid for work, and the occupation is licensed, you either go to jail or you are have a very severe fine. 6% of the 35% stated that they did not have a license or could do the work, which is the definition of certification. And another 3% stated that all who work would eventually be certified, bringing the total who are eventually must be licensed by government to about 38%. Who is licensed? Well, there's about an equal number of men and women who are licensed and certified. The blue line represents licensing, which is the most restrictive form. Certification represents individuals who have basically a right to title. In terms of percent licensed, by race. There aren't a lot of differences. Again, the blue line representing individuals who are licensed, the red representing individuals who are certified. And this is a breakdown by white, Hispanic, African-American, and others who mentioned this in the survey. Who is licensed by different sectors? In the private sectors, there is a great deal less licensing than in the public sector. That reflects, in large part, individuals who are teachers, nurses, all are licensed, and generally tend to work in the public sector. So this gives some overarching basic data, basic facts with respect to licensing by sectors. Now, what do licensed individuals have to do to become regulated or to maintain their status as a licensed practitioner? Well, about a little over 40% have to finish college or more, around 30%, and this is all just the individuals who are licensed, must have a high school education. About 87% of the occupations that are licensed require an exam. About 70% maintain a continuing education requirement in order to maintain their license, and about half have an internship requirement in order to be licensed in the survey. Now, there are various different views of occupational licensing. On the plus side, former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson noted that the state owes and attempts to perform a duty to protect the public from those who seek for one purpose or another to obtain money, the basic definition of licensing. When one does so through the practice of a calling, the state may have an interest in shielding the public against untrustworthy, the incompetent, or the irresponsible, suggesting there's a very important role for licensing. In contrast, former Nobel laureate and relatively famous economist Milton Friedman noted the overthrow of the medieval guild system was an indispensable early step in the rise of freedom in the Western world. It was a sign of the triumph of liberal ideas and recognized as such by the mid-19th century in Britain, the United States, and to a lesser extent in the continent of Europe. Men, he noted, could pursue whatever trade or occupation they wished with the by your leave of any government or quasi-governmental authority. In recent decades, there's been a retrogression, an increasing tendency for particular occupations to be restricted to individuals licensed by the state to practice. Now, the legal basis of licensing revolves around two different decisions. One in the 1880s, which really stated that licensing was a state area of control rather than the federal area of control, and it gave states primary control over licensing. In other areas, for example, in terms of labor relations law, that has generally been the venue of the federal government. In other areas, it's been largely local governments. But with respect to licensing, over two-thirds of all licensing takes place at the state level. In 1975, and this resulted in some of my work with the Federal Trade Commission, the Supreme Court stated that the bar's policy of an association's minimum fee schedule violated the Sherman Antitrust Act and was a prohibition in combinations in restraint of trade. The Supreme Court noted that the legal profession was not a public service, but rather a market-driven service, and as a result would fall under the Sherman Antitrust Act. Now, the rationale for licensing in terms of its background noted that through the 1880s through the 1930s, for example, in Minnesota, the legal profession and the medical profession were initially licensed during the period from the 1880s through the 1930s, and that included nursing and dentistry. This was largely a period of growth of knowledge within the professions. Individuals wanted to set a minimum bar. There were also reduction in transportation costs, So you didn't really know the practitioner. As a result, there was a reliance to a much greater extent on the state and urbanization, which also resulted in a reduction in knowing who the individuals are who you might receive a service from. Now, the geography of licensing, really, given that it's state by state, the dark lines or the most dark shaded areas reflect where the highest percentage of licensing in a particular state. In this case, you'll notice states like Illinois, the land of Lincoln, California, and Michigan and Connecticut are among the most licensed. During former President Clinton's position as governor of the state of Arkansas, it moved from being very low in terms of regulation to being among the most regulated states in terms of restriction, in terms of having a large percentage of its workforce licensed by the state. You'll notice Wisconsin, our next-door neighbor, tends to be more regulated in terms of coverage relative to the state of Minnesota. What's sort of the impact, and how can one think about this issue of licensing? And this comes from an article I wrote with a colleague at the Humphrey Institute, dealing with some of the effects of licensing, and might give you a framework for thinking about what might be a way to think about occupational regulation. Regulation generally comes in the form of pass rates, perhaps restrictive statutes in terms of letting individuals in, or reciprocity. And by that I mean the ability of individuals to move from one state to another. And how does this all fit together, and what are some of the effects in terms of the overall net quality to consumers? Well, one way to think of it is through suggesting regulation. And again, there are various ways in terms of education, pass rates, and reciprocity that might influence the flow of practitioners into a particular state. Well, in general, one would think that regulation would reduce the number of practitioners in a particular state. Setting those bars to entry would reduce the number of people who work in that occupation. Well, there are two potential impacts. One is on prices, and the other is on quality. The greater you restrict the flow of practitioners, there could be an impact on prices. There are just fewer people providing that service, and as a result, prices would go up. On the other hand, quality would go up as well. You're keeping out individuals who might be the least able. So the individuals who are in the occupation provide a high-quality service. Then what is the overall impact, and this is the public policy issue, the net quality effect in terms of consumers? Well, if prices go up, there would be a negative effect in terms of the effect to consumers. Individuals couldn't purchase the service. They would either have to do their own or ask their brother-in-law to provide that type of service. On the other hand, if quality goes up and the individuals in the occupation know more, then the net impact might be positive in terms of the effect to consumers. And there are certainly other factors like technological change that might result in quality effects increasing to consumers. Well, what might be the famous bell-shaped curve, which suggests what might happen to overall quality as a result of restricting entry? At point A, I guess I'm a college professor, so I kind of like these old bell-shaped curves in statistics. In part A, that might be the restriction of individuals who might be in a particular occupation based on their competency or quality. As you make the requirements more difficult, you move from C to D. That means the quality of the individuals in the occupation would go up as the requirements go up. However, there might be problems. That is, the problems might be of fencing out. That is, you have fewer people in the occupation. Although the individuals who are in the occupation are of higher quality, the access to care or the access to the service might decline as you restrict the number of individuals in an occupation. So that's sort of a framework or setting in terms of looking at this particular issue. Well, what are some of the results that have been shown in terms of some of the statistical analysis? And this was a study done comparing Minnesota and Wisconsin for a number of occupations, physician's assistants, physical therapists, and respiratory therapists over the period 1994 to 2001. Since that time, Minnesota has licensed these occupations. And what we found that there were no differences in complaints to the certification boards relative to the licensing boards in the two states, even though Minnesota was certified and Wisconsin had the more tougher form of regulation of occupational licensing. Other issues in terms of quality that might result is the effect, what happens to consumers as a result of licensing. And one bit of evidence might be from insurance rates. If insurance companies have to pay out higher premiums or have to pay out higher payouts as a result of incompetent or unscrupulous practitioners, they might give a break to practitioners in one state that's licensed relative to lower insurance premiums relative to another state that is unlicensed. And we looked at a number of different occupations, from counselors to marriage therapists to other occupations, to occupational therapists and occupational nurses and practical and vocational nurses, and none of the states were malpractice insurance rates significantly lower for similar persons controlling for age and experience in the states that required licensing. So at least insurance companies don't see licensing as providing the likelihood of a lower payout in terms of a jury award, which they would then be responsible for. Another area that has been of particular interest and has been a lot gathering a lot of headlines is in the area of mortgage brokers. And this is the result of a study that I did with Richard Todd, who is a colleague of mine at the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. And what we examined were mortgage broker regulations, and did it result in better outcomes? In general, the regulations had no effect. But one part of the regulation, bonding and net worth, which really resulted in some very important restrictions, that is, where those were higher, there were fewer brokers. Where those bonding and net worth requirements were higher, there were fewer brokers. There were also fewer subprime loans. There were also fewer loans overall. There were also higher foreclosure rates, in part because these the brokers, in part, ended up servicing some of the loans with fewer brokers. There were also higher foreclosure rates. And with tougher regulation through bonding and net worth, there were also higher priced loans. That is, with fewer individuals, the price of the service, in this case, loans, also increased. And these results suggested that licensing was more of an anti-consumer entry barrier, and it wasn't supportive of individuals through licensing gaining more human capital through additional qualifications or being more knowledgeable, and that resulting in better outcomes for consumers. Now, what's been the effect of licensing overall, the overarching effects on prices? And these are studies that were done mainly at the Federal Trade Commission with the individual constraining the horse. This was some of their studies that they have done in the 1970s through 2000. The impact of licensing on prices to consumers range from about 4% to 35%. Depending on the type of practice and location. Licensing laws fall disproportionately on low-income individuals, both as consumers, because they can't afford the higher-priced service, and as a potential entrance in terms of their being fenced out of the particular occupation. An example of this, perhaps an extreme example, albeit, is don't try this at home. This is from the Ann Arbor News in Michigan. Man does own root canal was the newspaper headline. David Krudoff is no dentist. He was a hired hand, had no dental insurance, and couldn't afford to go to a dentist, so he did it himself. So those are some of the potential outcomes. If you can't afford the price, You go to someone who is who doesn't know much about what he's doing. In this case, he did a good job, and the article in the new in the Ann Arbor News suggests that he did a pretty good job. Just do it yourself. What are the some of the other issues that might come up with licensing? This is another newspaper article from the Sunday Patriot News from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. In a clash of state licensing regulators and a conservative branch of the Pennsylvania Amish. One of its members was fined $1,000, later was fined again. For the last 13 years, Chris Zook has been pulling the teeth of his Amish neighbors. While he didn't get a university education, he read up on dentistry, acquired instruments, and found a good source of prescription painkiller. Zook was always available, according to his consumers, and had a good safety record.
Is he still practicing?
he is. If he is, he's not letting it be known.
Okay.
In this case, what are some of the overall effects? Well, here are some of the estimates that have been done by myself and colleagues on the overall effects of potential reallocation. That is, if consumers are paying a higher price, that would be the reallocation from a waitress in International Falls, perhaps, to someone who is a dentist in International Falls. So that might be the reallocation that that person would have to pay a higher price. That's the reallocation effect. The other effect is that you don't go and use the service. So there's a lost output effect. And the overall lost output effects are fairly substantial for you and me, but for the U.S. economy, it's less than 0.1% of national consumption expenditures. For Minnesota, estimates done by a group of students who worked under worked with me and also presented a report to the legislative auditor noted that the lost output for people not using the services was about $1.1 billion in 2003. So given that you are in the position of making these decisions, you should at least know what some of the consequences might be of your decisions, that they do, in fact, have some economic effects. And this might be the day after the particular piece of legislation is passed. Well, what are some of the major findings overall in terms of enhancement of quality and potential restriction of competition? Well, according to the data that I presented, that licensed occupations are approximately 29% of the workforce, more than twice as many as belong to unions, and this is 2008. What are some of the benefits? Certainly consumers in many cases like the idea of having a particular service that they're getting to be licensed. They view this as being loss aversion, that they may view that particular service as having been screened, and as a result, there might be a lesser chance of an incompetent or unscrupulous provider of a particular service. Some evidence that consumers who are covered by insurance or higher income categories gain from stricter licensing. And you may remember those are the individuals who have higher incomes who can then get the better trained provider of a service to give them that service. So those are the individuals who gain, but overall, it's very difficult to find any measurable effect on overall quality. And some of the reasons you might see individuals coming to this committee to become licensed is that licensing has some very clear wage effect. Licensing drives up prices, and the overall wage effect relative to unlicensed occupations in cross-section analysis is about 15%, and that is almost the effect, the same impact that unions tend to have on wages. So there's a really there's a fairly strong, moderate, depending on how you would deem that 15%, that there is an impact for practitioners of becoming regulated. Also, there's an impact on employment. Within an occupation, if you look at the same occupation across different states, employment is approximately 20% higher in states that do not require licensing relative to those who do for the same occupations, but also that differs by occupation and based on the methods that are used, but this is sort of the average effect. There's also much variation in the number of occupations licensed by the state and the percentage of the workforce that's covered by the laws, California being the most regulated, Kansas being the least regulated. And case studies show that political spending by the occupational associations is an important factor for who gets regulated. Oftentimes, they will tax their members and then seek to become regulated or put on a significant campaign to become regulated, either to be registered, certified, or licensed. And the overall effects, as I've mentioned, at least in $2,000, that would be larger now. Those are some of the overall effects economy-wide, both in terms of a reallocation from consumers to licensed practitioners and the lost output due to people who do without because of the price effects of licensing. The overall, all those are large numbers, they are relatively small relative to the economy or overall consumption expenditures. If you want to compare how we do it relative to other societies in the European Union, there are no tests generally to become licensed, but in the European Union, they regulate prices charged. So that there are prices charged in terms of the Goldfarb case, they actually set prices for physicians, for lawyers, and other licensed occupations. The wage effects tend to be very small because they regulate prices, the outputs, not the inputs, in Europe relative to the United States. And I thought I would conclude and then give you an opportunity to ask questions with a licensing fable that came out in a book, that one of the first books that came out in occupational licensing in the 1950s. And would conclude with, not long ago, the governor of a Midwestern state was approached by a representative of a particular trade anxious to enlist the governor's support in securing passage of legislation to license their occupation. Governor, they said, passage of this licensing act will ensure that only qualified people will practice this occupation. It will eliminate charlatans, incompetence, or frauds, and will thereby protect the safety of the people of the state. The governor, from long experience, was summed up somewhat skeptical. My distinguished guests, he asked, are you concerned with advancing the health, safety, and welfare of the people under the police powers of the state, or are you primarily interested in creating a monopoly situation and eliminate competition and raise prices? The spokesman for the occupational group smiled and said, Governor, we're interested in a little of each. And this was adapted from a Council of State Governors report in the 1950s. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd be delighted to try to answer questions.
Dr. Kleiner, you make it very interesting. I was nervous about this because I've never really had a course in economics other than what I've learned, I guess, being around this place for a few years, although not 200. I don't know. Do members have any questions? Senator Dahl, Senator Gerlach.
I do, Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
Well, Madam Chair and Dr. Kleiner, thanks for coming. This is there's no sort of course on these issues when we are elected. We just come and it's all on-the-job training. And over the years, we've had to figure out, well, when is it appropriate to license occupations and such. And so I think we probably all just develop our own sort of measuring sticks, barometers, whatever it is, to try to decide that. And of course, you know, public safety or pervasive fraud in an industry or various things to correct these problems. But all too often, we probably don't put enough thought into it. But I'm wondering what is your conclusion? Do you have any guidance for us? I mean, you had a lot of data, but as policymakers, what is your criteria for when you think where the balance point is? Because clearly there is a public interest, yet there's a downside. It's a double-edged sword is what I'm hearing you saying from your presentation, is that we should be thoughtful and careful, and that it cuts both ways. You got to find a balance. So what is your advice to us as legislators when we're making these decisions on finding the balance point? What would your checklist be, so to speak?
Dr. Kleiner.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, the key is evidence that needs to be provided by the occupation that individuals might have been harmed, or there's a very clear and present danger that individuals are going to be harmed if the police powers of the state are not used in terms of regulating a particular occupation. So I think the burden of proof for an occupation that is seeking to become especially licensed, which is the most restrictive form, is for that occupation to demonstrate that significant harm is going to be done to the consumers or the citizens of the state of Minnesota.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
I guess I'm just thinking out loud a little bit too here, but when you talk about harm, you're not talking about just purely physical harm, such as in a medical context or whatever it might be, but you're also talking maybe financial harm or any kind of harm at all? Or?
Dr. Kleiner.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, that would be one criteria, but again, what one often sees is that the members of the occupation seek to become regulated, and that the individuals will generally be members of the occupation seeing why there might be potential harm. It would also be important to make sure that consumers see or provide evidence of significant harm that might be caused if this occupation were not regulated. So that, in terms of providing criteria, I think it's important that consumers, the individuals who are going to be impacted the day after, to quote Thomas Friedman, to see what is going to be the long-term effects of regulation in terms of there being not only physical harm, but huge losses that might occur. So when one goes to a restaurant, you want to make sure that safety standards, and for example, in North Carolina, every restaurant in the state must post its cleanliness standards, and they're ranked by the state. And the first thing you see when you walk in the restaurant is how clean that restaurant is. So one that's getting a 99 out of 100, I'm likely to walk into. One getting a 50, I'll walk down the street. So that provides consumers with information, and that's very important. The idea there's a very important role for government in regulation. And I would argue, this comes from my experience with the Federal Trade Commission, is providing information to consumers in the most egregious cases where there can be what economists call externalities. That is, if a particular disease isn't found, there can be spreading of that disease to the whole community, and you want to make sure that person meets certain criteria, then you want to make sure that person has a high degree of competence. And one way might be occupational licensing. So those are perhaps examples of different ways of dealing with regulation. From my perspective, I would like to provide the most amount of information rather than using the heavy-handed state of fencing individuals out of the occupation, except in those very important cases where a particular disease might be spread, where there would be the falling down of a bridge. Those are issues where you want to make sure that there's a high degree of competence of the individuals who are looking at a particular public good.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understood what you were just saying there in terms of individual consumer safety and overall long-term effects versus short-term. As I'm looking at your presentation, and I was thinking here, in terms of economics only, just economics, it seems to me that in general terms, if I could sum up maybe your slideshow, there seems to be more negatives economically in terms of possible increase in prices. People won't pay higher prices for licensed professionals. Employment is higher in states that don't require licensing. There's no measurable effect on overall quality. A clear wage effect. Would you say that's a fair assumption that I just made about economics?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, I think that generally has been the case, that the negative, it hasn't been shown that there are very clear quality effects, and that's what you want to get. That's the benefits. The costs tend to be somewhat higher prices and higher wages for the individuals in the occupation. And it doesn't, unlike unions, which tend to narrow wage inequality, there hasn't been any evidence in our analysis and others that licensing tends to narrow wage inequality.
Thank
you. Any further questions? He's done. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Before the committee adjourns, I'd just like to make an announcement that on Tuesday the 17th, before the committee, will be Senate File 376, authored by Senator Higgins, relating to interior design. And on Thursday the 19th, there will be no meeting, so that's probably good news. But anyway, with that, the meeting is adjourned.